A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He makes a fascinating claim right at the top. No society has ever existed in which arbitrarily murdering people was considered acceptable. And he wants us to trace where non-religiously inspired basic legal principles actually came from. Two specific questions. One, when were these first documented without explicit reference to religious precedent? Two, has this fundamental legal framework ever been described and agreed upon in a way that superseded religious divisions?
That claim about murder is doing a lot of work. It's technically true, but it's also a bit of a magic trick. Because the word arbitrarily is carrying the entire weight of the argument.
Nobody wakes up and says, we should permit random stabbing. But plenty of societies have said, we permit killing this category of person under these circumstances. The question is whether that distinction holds up under scrutiny.
The prompt's two questions are actually harder to answer than they look. The first one sends us digging through clay tablets in ancient Mesopotamia. The second one sends us to the International Criminal Court and the thread connecting them. The idea that law can be legitimate without divine backing. That's a 4,000-year argument that still isn't settled.
Let's start by defining what we actually mean when we say non-religiously inspired law. Because the answer is trickier than you might think.
The distinction I want to draw is between religious content and religious justification. A law code can contain rules that look secular, property disputes, contract enforcement, torts, while still claiming its authority from the gods. That's the Code of Hammurabi. It opens with the god An and the god Enlil, appointing Hammurabi to bring justice to the land. The actual provisions cover ox-scoring incidents and builder liability, but the framework is explicitly theological.
We're not asking whether a law happens to align with religious morality. We're asking where the law claims its authority comes from. Who or what is the source of the "you must do this" part?
And that question matters because it shapes what happens when someone challenges the law. If the authority is divine, you can't really negotiate with it. If it's human, you can amend it. If it's rational, you can argue with it. The shift from one to the other is the whole story.
The trick is, even thoroughly secular legal systems often borrow from religious moral intuitions without admitting it. The prohibition on murder didn't originate in a philosophy seminar. It came from somewhere. The question is whether the law's formal justification mentions that somewhere.
Here's our route. We're going to trace three moments. First, the ancient world, where we find secular legal thinking that most people don't know about. Second, the Enlightenment rupture, when someone finally says the quiet part out loud and argues that law doesn't need God at all. Third, the modern attempt to build a universal secular framework that actually binds nations. And, at the end, we answer both of the prompt's questions directly.
To find the first secular law, we have to go back further than most people expect, all the way to ancient Mesopotamia, around 2100 BCE.
Most people think the Code of Hammurabi is the oldest law code. It's not. The Code of Ur-Nammu predates it by roughly 300 years, 2100 to 2050 BCE versus Hammurabi's 1754 BCE. And the difference in how they justify themselves is striking.
What does Ur-Nammu's prologue actually say?
It credits the king himself with establishing justice. Ur-Nammu describes standardizing weights and measures, protecting orphans and widows, ensuring the powerful don't exploit the weak. The authority comes from the king's own actions and wisdom. There's no divine appointment ceremony. The gods are mentioned, but they're not the source of the law's legitimacy. The king is saying, I did this because I'm the king, and it's my job.
Which is a massive conceptual leap. I'm doing this because it's the right thing for a ruler to do, rather than the gods told me to.
Contrast that with Hammurabi. His prologue is a theophany. Shamash, the sun god and god of justice, literally hands him the laws. The famous stele in the Louvre, and I've seen it, it's breathtaking, shows Shamash presenting the rod and ring, the symbols of authority, to Hammurabi. The message is unambiguous. These laws are divine in origin. the king is just the delivery mechanism.
Within 300 years, we actually went backward in secular justification.
In a sense, yes, but it's not a linear story. Different civilizations made different choices at different times. The next big moment is the one I find genuinely thrilling, and it comes from Rome.
Of the 12 tables.
451 to 450 BCE, Rome's foundational legal text. And here's what's remarkable: no religious preamble, no invocation of gods, no divine mandate. Just 12 bronze tablets of procedural and civil law displayed in the Roman Forum, and every Roman schoolchild was required to memorize them.
Memorize the entire thing?
The entire thing. Cicero talks about boys learning them by heart. Imagine American schoolchildren being required to memorize the entire U.S. code.
There's a four-word reaction line here somewhere about modern education standards, but I'll resist.
The content is fascinatingly granular. Table 1 covers how to summon someone to court. Table 3 deals with debt, and this is where we need to address the prompt's claim about murder, because the 12 tables contain something that complicates it severely.
The debt provision.
Table 3, provision 6. If a debtor has multiple creditors and can't pay, the creditors may cut the debtor into pieces and divide the body. The law explicitly says if they cut more or less than their share, it's without prejudice, meaning no penalty for getting the proportions wrong.
We have a secular law code, no divine justification, displayed in the public square, memorized by children, that explicitly permits cutting a person into pieces for debt.
This is why the prompt's claim about arbitrary murder needs the word arbitrarily to function. The 12 tables didn't permit random killing. It permitted very specific, legally defined killing under very specific circumstances. The killing was authorized, regulated, and proportionate to the debt. From inside the Roman legal framework, that wasn't arbitrary. From outside, it is dismemberment for unpaid loans.
Which gets at something deeper. Every society defines murder in a way that excludes the killings it wants to permit. Execution isn't murder. Killing in war isn't murder. Killing in self-defense isn't murder. The debtor dismemberment isn't murder in Roman law. It's a lawful remedy. The category murder is always defined by what it leaves out.
Those exclusions map directly onto social hierarchies. The 12 tables also specify different penalties for breaking a free man's bone versus a slave's bone. The free man gets monetary compensation. The slave gets a lower amount paid to the owner. The law itself encodes status distinctions, and those distinctions determine who can be killed under what circumstances.
When we ask whether any society accepted arbitrary murder, the answer depends entirely on who counts as a person whose killing would be arbitrary.
Jump forward nearly 1,000 years. The Corpus Juris Civilis, the Justinian Code, compiled between 529 and 534 CE. Justinian was a Christian emperor. The empire was officially Christian. And yet the code itself attempts to systematize Roman law as a rational system, not a theological one. It draws on centuries of juristic writing. Ulpian, Gaius, Papinian, who were reasoning from principles, not revelation.
The template for law as a rational system.
The digest portion of the Corpus Juris is basically a curated anthology of Roman legal thought. And the jurists are constantly asking, what's the fair outcome here? Not what do the gods command? They're working within a tradition that treats law as something human reason can discover and refine. Justinian's Christian faith is present in the empire's self-understanding, but the legal text itself doesn't derive its authority from scripture.
Which creates this fascinating hybrid. A Christian emperor producing a legal code that functions without constant reference to Christianity.
That hybrid becomes the foundation for European civil law for the next 1,000 years. The medieval glossators and commentators worked on the Corpus Juris as if it were a rational system to be interpreted and extended. They were often clergy. They brought theological assumptions. But the method was analytical, not devotional.
By the time we get to the Enlightenment, the pieces are in place for a radical break. Someone finally says the quiet part out loud.
That someone is Hugo Grotius, De jure belli et pacis, on the law of war and peace. And he writes a sentence that still makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. He says that natural law would be valid, etiamsi deremus non esse diem, even if we should concede that there is no God.
That's bold for 1625.
It's breathtaking. Grotius wasn't an atheist. He was a devout Christian who'd been imprisoned for his religious views. but he made the philosophical move that changes everything. He said, let's bracket the theological question. Let's ask what law would look like if we built it entirely from human reason and human nature, and he argued it would look the same. The content of natural law doesn't depend on divine revelation. It's accessible to any rational person.
He's not saying God doesn't exist. He's saying the law doesn't need God to be valid.
That distinction is everything. It opens the door to legal systems that can function across religious divisions. If law is grounded in reason and human nature, then a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, and an atheist can all arrive at the same legal principles through the same rational process. They don't need to share a theology, they need to share a method.
This sets up the Enlightenment Project. But the Enlightenment's actual legal documents are messier than the philosophy.
The U.S. Declaration of Independence, 1776, invokes the laws of nature and of nature's God. That's a hybrid. It's not the God of Abraham. It's a deistic formulation. God as the creator of a rational natural order, not God as the giver of specific commandments. But it's still a theological claim. Jefferson wasn't ready to go full Grotius.
The French Declaration of the Rights of Man, 1789.
Natural, inalienable, and sacred rights of man. But it was debated fiercely. The French National Assembly argued about whether to mention God explicitly. Some delegates wanted in the presence of the Supreme Being. Others wanted no religious reference at all. The compromise was sacred, which gestures at transcendence without naming it.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper in theological terms.
That's exactly what it is. The French couldn't decide whether they were doing something religious or secular, so they did something that could be read either way. And that ambiguity persists in a lot of modern human rights language. Inherent dignity? Inherent in what? The document declines to specify.
Which brings us to the 20th century, and the prompt's second question. Has a fundamental legal framework been described and agreed upon that supersedes religious divisions?
The closest we've come is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, and the Nuremberg trials 3 years earlier are the necessary prelude.
Because Nuremberg had to solve a specific legal problem.
The defense argued nullum crimen sine lege, no crime without law. The Nazi defendant said, what we did wasn't illegal under German law at the time. You're prosecuting us for acts that weren't crimes when we committed them. And this wasn't a frivolous argument. It's a fundamental principle of criminal law in most legal systems. You can't punish someone for something that wasn't illegal when they did it.
The tribunal had to find a way to say, this was wrong. That didn't depend on a specific statute.
They did it by appealing to universal principles, crimes against humanity. The idea that some acts are so fundamentally wrong that they violate norms that exist independently of any written law. The tribunal didn't cite scripture. It didn't cite divine command. It cited the laws of humanity and the dictates of the public conscience. Those are secular justifications, even if they're philosophically thin.
Philosophically thin is generous. The dictates of the public conscience is practically a shrug.
But it worked. 24 major Nazi leaders were prosecuted. 12 sentenced to death, 7 to prison terms, 3 acquitted. The precedent was set. Individuals can be held accountable under international law for acts that shock the conscience of humanity, even if those acts were legal under domestic law at the time.
3 years later, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights tries to write down what those universal principles actually are.
The drafting process is one of the most remarkable exercises in cross-cultural negotiation in history. An 18-member committee chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt. Representatives from China, Lebanon, Chile, France, the Soviet Union, India. Multiple religious traditions, multiple philosophical traditions, multiple legal systems. And they made a deliberate decision to avoid religious language. There were proposals to include God or the Creator as the source of rights. They were debated and rejected. The final text says rights derive from the inherent dignity of the human person. That phrase is doing an enormous amount of philosophical work while committing to almost nothing.
Inherent in what?
That's the question. The drafters knew they couldn't agree on the answer, so they agreed on the formulation. The final vote was 48-0 with 8 abstentions. The abstainers included the Soviet bloc, Saudi Arabia, and South Africa, each for different reasons. The Soviets objected to the emphasis on individual rights over collective rights. Saudi Arabia objected to the provision on freedom of religion and marriage. South Africa objected to the racial equality provisions.
Even the abstentions tell you where the fault lines are.
Those fault lines haven't gone away. The Universal Declaration is the closest thing we have to a universally agreed secular legal framework. It's been translated into more than 500 languages. It's the foundation for the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. But it's not a treaty. It's a declaration. It's aspirational. It has no enforcement mechanism.
Which brings us to the International Criminal Court.
The Rome Statute, 1998, entered into force in 2002. The ICC has jurisdiction over genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. This is the enforcement arm of the universal principles the Universal Declaration gestured at. But here's the reality as of May 2026. 123 states are parties to the Rome Statute. That's a majority of the world's nations. But the United States is not a party. China is not a party. Russia is not a party. India is not a party. Israel is not a party.
The countries with the most military power and the largest populations are outside the system.
That's the fundamental tension. Universal jurisdiction exists in theory. Belgium passed a law in 1993 allowing its courts to prosecute war crimes regardless of where they occurred. Spain used universal jurisdiction to go after Pinochet in 1998. The ICC issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin in 2023 over the deportation of Ukrainian children. But enforcement depends on politics. Putin can't travel to ICC member states without risking arrest, but he's still the president of Russia. The warrant hasn't stopped the war.
The answer to the prompt's second question is, yes, in theory, but no, in practice.
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, plus the Geneva Conventions, plus the Rome Statute, constitute a secular legal framework that claims to supersede religious and cultural divisions. The principles have been described and agreed upon by most of the world's nations. But the enforcement is selective, the major powers have opted out, and the philosophical foundations remain contested.
That philosophical contestation is worth sitting with, because the secular frameworks keep borrowing from religious intuitions without admitting it. Inherent dignity is doing the work that created in God's image used to do. The language changed, but the underlying moral conviction might not have.
This is the problem Grotius tried to solve and didn't fully solve. He said natural law would be valid even without God, but he didn't explain why anyone should feel bound by natural law. Social contract theory. Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau tried to fill that gap. We're bound by law because we've implicitly agreed to be bound. But that's a metaphor, not an empirical fact. Nobody actually signed a social contract.
The social contract is the glockenspiel of political philosophy. It's always there in the background, making a pleasant sound, but nobody's quite sure why it's supposed to be authoritative.
When you push on it, the whole thing can collapse into power. If law is just what humans agree to, and humans can disagree, then law is ultimately whatever the strongest faction can enforce. That's Thrasymachus in Plato's Republic. Justice is the advantage of the stronger. Secular legal theory has been wrestling with that challenge for 2,500 years and hasn't fully answered it.
Where does that leave us? The prompt asks two specific questions. Let's answer them directly.
When were non-religiously inspired basic legal principles first documented without explicit reference to religious precedent? The Code of Ur-Nammu, around 2100 BCE, is the earliest surviving example. Its prologue credits the king, not the gods, with establishing justice. The 12 Tables of Rome, 451 BCE, are the first major Western secular legal framework, no divine invocation, just procedural and civil law on bronze tablets. And the Justinian Code, 529 CE, systematized Roman law as a rational enterprise even under a Christian emperor.
Those ancient codes don't look secular in the modern sense. They're secular in justification, not in content. Ur-Nammu still mentions the gods. The 12 tables still encodes class distinctions we'd find morally abhorrent. The shift is gradual. From divine command to ruler's authority, to rational system to social contract, to universal human rights.
Has a fundamental legal framework been described and agreed upon that supersedes religious divisions? The closest we have is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, drafted in 1948 by a multi-religious, multicultural committee that deliberately avoided religious language. It was adopted 48-0 with 8 abstentions. It's the foundation for subsequent human rights treaties. The International Criminal Court, established in 2002, is the enforcement mechanism. But 123 states are parties, and the major military powers are not. So the framework exists on paper, but is politically constrained in practice.
There's also a deeper issue worth naming. The secular frameworks we've built assume a shared commitment to human dignity that may not actually be shared. When the Universal Declaration says rights derive from inherent dignity, it's making a claim that sounds self-evident to people raised in liberal democracies. But if you believe that dignity comes from God, or from membership in a community, or from fulfilling a specific role, the Declaration's formulation might not persuade you.
This is where the contemporary case studies get interesting. Take Israel, which operates without a single written constitution. The legal system is a patchwork of Ottoman law, British mandate law, Israeli basic laws, and judicial precedent. The source of legal authority is constantly being negotiated. Religious parties argue for halakhic foundations. Secular parties argue for democratic principles. The system works, mostly, but it's a live experiment in whether secular and religious legal thinking can coexist without a single foundational document.
Or take the question of territorial sovereignty. The whole concept of universal jurisdiction, the idea that a court in Belgium can prosecute crimes committed in Rwanda, depends on the idea that some norms transcend national borders. But borders themselves are historical constructs. The modern nation-state system is only a few centuries old. The tension between sovereignty and universal jurisdiction isn't a bug in international law. It's the central design challenge.
That's why the prompt's question is so timely. We're living through a period where the post-1945 international legal order is under strain from multiple directions. Major powers are withdrawing from treaties. The ICC is accused of selective prosecution. Religious legal systems are gaining political influence in multiple regions. The question of whether secular law can hold without religious backing isn't just a historical curiosity. It's a live political question.
For listeners trying to make sense of this in their own news consumption, here's the practical framework. When someone says this is a fundamental human right, ask what framework they're invoking. Are they appealing to religious law? Each framework has different assumptions about where rights come from and who gets to enforce them. The answer usually reveals more than the statement itself.
Pay attention to the word universal. It's doing a lot of work in legal language that it maybe can't sustain. The Universal Declaration is called universal, but 8 countries abstained. The ICC claims universal jurisdiction, but most of the world's population lives outside its effective reach. The aspiration is genuine. The reality is patchy.
The prompts claim about murder. No society has ever accepted arbitrary murder. Turns out to be a useful entry point into a much bigger question. Societies have always prohibited some killings and permitted others. The boundaries of the permissible have shifted over time, but the pattern is constant. What changes is who counts as a person, what counts as justification, and who gets to decide.
The search for a secular legal framework is really the search for a way to answer those questions without saying, because God said so. Namu said, because I'm the king and I said so. The Romans said, because the 12 tables say so. Grotius said, because reason says so. The Universal Declaration says, because human dignity says so. Each formulation tries to ground law in something that doesn't require a specific theology. None of them has fully succeeded.
Before we wrap up, there's one more question worth asking. One that might define the next century of legal thinking. What happens when the authority isn't human at all? The EU AI Act, passed in 2024, is the first major attempt to regulate artificial intelligence through law. But it's regional, not universal. Different countries are developing different frameworks. And we're moving toward a world where some decisions, who gets a loan, who gets bail, who gets flagged at a border, are made by systems that no human fully understands.
The algorithmic black box problem.
If law has been moving from divine authority to human authority to rational authority, the next step might be algorithmic authority. Law without any human in the loop. And then the question of secular justification becomes even more urgent. What does it mean for a legal system to be legitimate when the decision maker isn't a person, a king, or a god, but a model?
The current EU approach is to require human oversight and transparency. But that's a stopgap. As systems get more complex, meaningful human oversight becomes harder. And the philosophical question, can an algorithm be a legitimate source of legal authority, hasn't even been seriously debated yet.
Which connects back to the 4,000-year thread we've been pulling. Every era has had to answer the same question. Why should anyone obey the law? The answers change. The question doesn't.
The search for a universal secular legal framework is really the search for a way to say, this is wrong, without needing to say, God says so. We've been trying for 4 millennia. We've produced remarkable documents and built institutions that, for all their flaws, have prevented wars and punished atrocities. But we haven't fully succeeded, and maybe the search itself is the point. The attempt to ground law in something everyone can access, reason, dignity, conscience, is a project that keeps failing forward.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The oldest known manuscript from Mauritius is a fragment of a Roman legal text from the 3rd century CE written on papyrus, discovered in a cave in 1901. The text concerns maritime insurance disputes, and the ink contains traces of horseshoe crab blood, which was used in antiquity as a binding agent for certain pigments, though the practice was rare and poorly documented outside of Indian Ocean trade routes.
Horseshoe crab blood in Roman legal manuscripts from Mauritius.
That is so aggressively specific, I don't even know where to begin. This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird props, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.